from the Star Reynolds Sports Desk, your 93.3 KJR-FM Sports Headlines.
Sports Headlines going into the 5 o'clock hour, brought to you by VenueKings.com. Mariners and Astros game 2 of the series tonight after last night's eventful 7-4 win. Chris Flexen against Justin Verlander. Dusty Baker suspended one game, and pitcher Hector Neris, who beaned Ty France and threw it. Eugenio Suarez last night was suspended for 4 games. Scott Servais has been fined. DK Metcalf has decided to skip Hawks minicamp, at least day one. He may show up tomorrow. Who knows? Greg Bell reporting that a league source told him that the team did not excuse the absence. The fine would almost be $90,000 if he skips all 3 games. Angels have fired manager Joe Maddon as they suffer through a 12-game losing streak. Avalanche rally to win in Edmonton 6-5 in overtime to sweep the Western Conference Finals. And the LIV Tour head man, Greg Norman, says Tiger Woods turned down nearly a $1 billion deal to play on the tour. The USGA has decided to allow all players who have qualified to play in their tournament, even if they decided to leave the PGA Tour for the LIV, they will be allowed to play. So Dustin Johnson's allowed to play, Phil Mickelson's allowed to play, and DJ today officially resigning from the PGA Tour. He will play on the LIV Tour. John Wilner coming up right now.
It's time for our weekly Pac-12 conversation with San Jose Mercury News reporter John Wilner. Brought to you by Simply Seattle. Our friends at SimplySeattle.com have the most amazing collection of all things Seattle. Seahawks gear, UW hats, and the largest selection of Sonics gear anywhere in the world. Learn more at SimplySeattle.com.
John Wilner, brought to you by SimplySeattle.com. John, how you doing, man? We got Johnny? I don't hear Johnny.
I'm good.
There you are. We're doing a little training in the back room, John. Jackson's scrambling.
So what happened? You guys moved into a new building and Softy took a vacation?
Yes, that is pretty much how it's gone. You and I have talked a lot lately. It's been a lot of fun. We haven't seen a lot of Dave Softy Muller recently, but he'll be back come football season. He'll be back in full shape now. He'll be back on Monday. He's enjoying a week out of the Pacific Northwest, actually down in your neck of the woods in Northern California. So you might hear him if you open up the door. You might hear Softy's voice. He might be close enough to you. But John, let's start. You know, we always start with football, but let's start with hoops today, just because it's in the news, and a good day, a good 2 days for both of the Northwest schools in the transfer portal.
Yeah, they both got big pickups. I think the Washington State getting Guy back is really huge, especially just for the overall morale and atmosphere of the program, because they lost so many kids to the portal, but this time they retained one of their one of the best young big men in the league. So I think that'll help. And boy, the Huskies pick up with Keon Brooks. I mean, that's gigantic for Mike Hopkins, I think. It could end up being a similar deal to Terrell Brown, where the guy comes in and just really elevates the rest of the players and keeps the Huskies competitive.
They're going to need somebody to pass in the ball. However, John, they got to hit that portal for point guards.
Yeah, heavy. The second foot's got to come down, right? We got to get a point guard in here, right?
No, they will. They do. And I like the way... obviously it's all guesswork, but you can kind of picture him with Big Frank in the middle of the zone and Noah Williams. And I think he and Williams will probably work pretty well together as your wings. So you can see that they're putting together a lineup that may be, real competitive if they can figure out what's going on out front.
I'd love to believe you, John. I would love to believe you, but we saw it last year. You bring in a whole new team, basically, and they were okay, despite having maybe the most electric scorer in the entire conference at the head of the snake. Well, they lose that guy. They lose their second option in Emmett Matthews. And, yeah, they're starting to replace them with good players. But to me, it just seems like rinse and repeat, John. I mean, how many times are we just going to go through totally rebuilding a team in the offseason in the transfer portal and end up 18-16? I mean, I just don't see how. I guess what I'm saying is I don't see the end game for Washington where it ends in a trip to the Sweet 16 regularly.
No, I agree. It's tough to see that, but there's a lot of schools that are living with the overhaul in the transfer portal, you know, every year. I mean, Arizona State is going through it even to a greater degree than Washington on a year-to-year basis. Oregon does it too. You know, I don't know if it will take one kind of next-level season for Mike Hopkins, you know, 20, 24 wins, in order to convince, you know, to kind of get back to building through traditional recruiting. It certainly matters what the pipeline is in the Pacific Northwest, right? If you don't have regular elite recruits coming up through the high school scene, then you have more pressure to turn to the transfer portal. So there's a whole lot of factors involved. But yeah, I mean, it's certainly fair to wonder if they can get out of that cycle of mediocrity.
John, I couldn't help. I needed to ask you about this because I couldn't help paying attention to Ryan Day, and he's speaking to like 100 members of the community in Columbus, Ohio, and he tells them, we are going to need about $13 million in NIL money to maintain our roster. It almost sounded like he was doing a capital campaign.
Yeah. Fundraiser.
It was interesting because AJ Hawk, he comes and he says, this is fundraising season. And he kind of thought that everything, the Saban, Jimbo Fisher, the Ryan Day, all of this is just coaches already just making the call out. Like, even though they're talking about how bad the system is this and that, they're already telling everybody, this is what we got to do. So pour that money into these collectives and so on and so forth. I'm wondering how you're reading that situation. And the Pac-12 being what the Pac-12 is there going to be a coach who actually goes and to his community and says, we need $15 million to maintain our team?
Well, I definitely think that there's a little bit to what you're saying of the, you know, it's fundraising season. Like, you know, once one coach does it, everybody else has to do it. But I also think that you do need, you know, I don't know if it's exactly $13 million, right? But you certainly need, for your quarterback and then your top 15 or 20 guys, you probably do need close to $10 million, right, to be able to compete with the other elite schools who are all, you know, gonna be making offers, right? It's basically free agency 24/7, 365. And not really with a salary cap, to be honest. So it's out of control. There's no doubt. And I do think that some Pac-12 schools will, I mean, Oregon, I think you can pretty much count on Oregon doing what Oregon thinks is necessary to win the Pac-12 and compete for a playoff berth. But a lot of it, Jerry, has to do with the passion of your donor base, how deep the pockets are, how committed the donors are to being a part of the roster building process. But it's easy to see how this thing gets sideways too, because all of a sudden, you know, you got a donor who's putting up $1 million or $2 million for a player, an edge rusher or a receiver, and that kid's not playing. And then the donor all of a sudden goes to the head coach, hey, I'm paying for this kid. Yeah. You're not playing him. So it can get sideways that way. Yeah. And there's also, at some point, there's going to be a market correction, right? Because a lot of these businessmen who are very successful are going to see, hey, it might not be worth 500 grand for me to basically pay for a left tackle who, you know, may or may not be an impact player. So I don't know when that market correction is going to happen, but you know, next 2 or 3 years, I think we'll see something.
Jerry and I had a discussion off the air before you were coming on about the Huskies' plan over the last year versus like Oregon's plan over the last year when it comes to NIL, and how willing they were to kind of dip their feet in the muck, right? And Washington was obviously not as willing to dip their feet in the muck. And my theory, and I don't know if this is right or not, my theory is that Washington said, all right, this is going to be illegal pretty soon. We don't want to go down the illegal road and get that started before, you know, and then have to shift course 9 months from now. And we have seen the NCAA come out and say, hey, listen, we are going to be cracking down on the perpetrators of NIL, for, you know, pay to play type thing for recruits. Do you think that was a good decision by Washington, or do you think that set them back and that Oregon will be ahead in the long run for kind of being willing to wade down that mucky road?
Well, I think Oregon is ahead. But I also am not sure that that's that much different than it's been the last few years, right? Oregon has consistently pulled in the best recruiting class in the Pac-12 USC has, you know, has been down because they were down with Clay Helton. It's been the Ducks. They've been out recruiting Washington, and now I don't know that it's that much different. I don't think it means that Washington can't compete, but Washington's going to have to do a real good job. If you're not getting the same, quite the same caliber of players, you got to do a better job of evaluating and teaching. I don't know how much of it is we don't want to go down the road because we might have to shift in the reverse and go backwards.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's more of an institutional decision that, and it's a different mentality in Eugene as it is on Montlake. And I mean, I think some of that has to do with the Nike influence. Oregon has been playing to win a national championship for Phil Knight for a while now. And I think that that is still happening. It's just taking a slightly different form with NIL.
It's crazy, John, because you go down this moral path, and it seems like, all right, well, that's great that you have these morals, but it gets you further and further and further behind. And I'm wondering, I wanted to ask you a question about regulation. And you keep talking about, you know, as Dick was saying, like the NCAA, we're going to crack down on the most egregious pay-to-play and all of this. Like, what is regulation going to ultimately look like? And who in the world is going to lead that effort? Mm-hmm. That, because everybody has punted on this issue, and that's why we are where we are.
I think the only way they can really regulate it is if Congress steps in. A big part of the problem is, well, certainly the NCAA kind of has abdicated authority over it, but you've got 50, I don't know, there's probably 40 different rules across 50 states. And that's a big part of the problem is you can do some things that are perfectly legal in some states and they aren't legal in other states. I mean, there's a few states in the SEC that have now made it okay for athletic department employees to basically help broker deals between the athletes and the NIL collectives. I don't think that's the case anywhere in the Pac-12. You've got the state of Mississippi has said, basically, you can start negotiating an NIL deal once an athlete makes a verbal commitment. They can start doing that in seventh grade if they want. So the fact that there are so many different rules across the country means that and as soon as the NCAA starts to do anything that is going to appear like they're capping the player's ability to earn money in the private sector, they're going to get slapped with an antitrust suit, and they're probably going to lose based on what the Supreme Court said last summer.
Yeah.
So they're waiting and crossing their fingers that Congress will give them some kind of antitrust shield to allow them to better regulate this situation.
John, I had a fascinating interaction when I was watching game two of the NBA Finals with my 12-year-old son, and it kind of got me thinking about what kids these days think about college athletes and whether they're amateur athletes or professional athletes. And we're watching the game. Steph's got the ball. He's squaring up on Peyton Pritchard. My son obviously knows Steph. He didn't know who Peyton Pritchard was. He just saw this white dude guarding Steph, right? And so he was like, go at him, Steph, let's go. And I go, oh, dude, that's the Husky Strangler right there. And he goes, what do you mean? I go, well, that's Peyton Pritchard. He killed the dogs many, many times. And my son said, he goes, oh, he doesn't know. I mean, I think he knows that Oregon's the Nike school, right? But he called, instead of saying it Phil Knight, he goes, oh, I bet the Ducks owner paid him a lot of money. That's what he said. He goes, I bet the Ducks owner paid him a lot of money. And I said, well, no, because when he was playing, it was illegal for, you know, Nike to pay him. And he said, well, somebody must have been paying him then, right? I was just thinking about how his mind was working. I was like, my only answer was, yeah, probably, right? I mean, it's amazing how kids, teenagers, college kids, and now even preteens like my son view college sports and college athletes so much differently than we did. Not only just we did when we were kids, how differently we viewed it 10 years ago.
Yeah, your son's future mayor of Seattle. it's a totally different, there's no doubt, totally different era, right? And the thing is that the NCAA argued for years, right? The Ed O'Bannon lawsuits over EA, mm-hmm. I think that started in like 2006 or 2007. And the NCAA argued for years that, oh, these kids can't. Part of the appeal of the college model is that these kids are amateurs and they're not getting paid. If they start getting paid, it's going to turn fans off. And everybody knew that was a cockamamie argument. And now we're seeing it because most people, you know, don't really care if the athletes are getting paid over the table or under the table, to be honest with you. And if it's still popular, so the NCAA's argument kind of fizzled. It's a different era, right? I mean, what's happening right now could never have happened in the 50s or 60s, but everybody looks at it differently.
Yeah,
that's an excellent point, John. We're in year one of the NIL, the first real college season of this era. And you look at those football ratings and you look at the television ratings for the NCAA tournament. No one is looking at that and saying that, oh, because this has become a little more professionalized, that it's not a sport that I'm attracted to.
Nope. They're rooting, you know, and I think that this is potentially important in the next era if athletes try to become employees. I really think that most fans are rooting for the name on the front of the jersey, right? They're because they have an affinity for their alma mater or their hometown school, right? And they don't really care if the quarterback's getting $1 million and the backup left guard's getting 25 cents. They're rooting for their school, right? And so it will be interesting to see, you know, what happens. Do people still feel that way if the schools have to pay these kids and they become employees and you end up in a situation where you can get cut, all the normal regulations that follow the economics of pro sports, if that ends up getting implemented in college sports, will fans of the universities and alumni of the universities care as much at that point? And I don't know.
And yet you can use the names on the back of the jersey to market and promote the names on the front of the jersey. And I was just talking to Jerry about that a few moments ago about the Huskies. And, you know, the Huskies, there was one point, I know a lot of people that weren't living back here in the early to mid-90s, but the Huskies were every bit as big, if not bigger, than the Seattle Seahawks 25, 30 years ago in this city. And yet the Huskies today are struggling to get fans, even though they win at a pretty solid, consistent rate. I mean, last year notwithstanding, they win at a solid, consistent rate. They went to 3 BCS bowl games in a row, and it really didn't show up in the attendance all that much. And I'm wondering what Washington needs to do to try to get fans in the seats before they even start to win. And I'm thinking using these players, using their brand new coach, and marketing this football team to this city would be a good idea, and I just don't see it. And maybe they got a big marketing plan coming out for August, but I think that's waiting too long. You need these people to buy tickets.
Yeah, I would suspect that you'll see it ramp up, you know, once we get into July. But that's the same problem. I mean, there's an attendance problem all over college football, right? Not just from the pandemic, but there's so many competing interests, and it's certainly more pronounced on the West Coast. I mean, you've seen what the Rose Bowl looks like these days when the Bruins are playing, right? But it's happening everywhere. It's just harder to get fans in. Part of it's the night games. Part of it's the fact that some of the kickoffs aren't set till a week in advance or 2 weeks in advance. And it's just harder. The home viewing experience is better. It's better than it has ever been. And in some cases, it's better than being at the game.
Well, I still love going to the game. We were just talking about, you know, not wanting to go to Mariners games when it's, you know, 55 degrees out and raining and the roof's on. But I got no problem. I got no problem going to a Husky football game when it's 48 degrees and sideways rain in November. I just love it. I just think it's there's something about going to a college football game that I just absolutely love. And I know that there are hundreds of thousands of people in this city, if not a million people in this city, that love it too, that used to go, that just don't go anymore. And I guess I'm trying to figure out why that is. And maybe you're right. Maybe it's the 65-inch TV in their living room that they didn't have in 1992. They had the 19-inch Trinitron in the corner in 1992, and it just wasn't the same. But John, it's always a pleasure. Go ahead.
The kickoffs. I mean, you got to say the kickoffs are a big issue.
Yeah, that's true. Except Haven't we gotten used to those now? Haven't we gotten used to 7:30 kickoffs now? We've been doing them for like 20 years.
Well, I think so. I think people have gotten used to not going.
That's the thing. Fair point. Great stuff, John. We'll talk to you next week.
All right, guys. Thanks a lot.
You bet. John Wilner brought to you by Simply Seattle. Yeah, maybe he's right. I've never really minded the night games. I really loved the night games at first because they were a novelty. Now I like the night games for a completely different reason. Because I'm a dad. I can do all my kids' stuff on a Saturday. Golf tournaments,
sure.
Swim meets, flag football games, basketball, whatever. And then I'm like, okay, it's 6 o'clock. Time to go to the Husky game, you know? Instead of me having to decide, 12:30 start, 1 o'clock start, do I go to the Husky game or do I go watch my kid play?
Yeah, I think we're still trying to evaluate the health and attention and everything by old metrics when we really need to consider it all. You got to consider streaming, television, the gate, all of these things. I think you have to kind of combine everything and see what your revenue looks like instead of it saying having one leg compete against the other. I mean, if people are engaged and people are watching and like the television contract is rich, that's fine. If you're, you know, I mean, we all want to have 72,000 every single game, right? But what I'm saying is there's a formula to where you could average 62,000, but everything else, and it becomes more lucrative than, and people, like, one thing I've learned from the newspaper business mm-hmm. and how it's changed, technology and people's habits change the business models of everything. Right. And either you can get down with it or you can't. And then you start to struggle. And so I think you really got to think about your audience, not in terms of like we're going to get everybody, but like who is really interested in watching games live. And in terms of like the game day experience, what can we do to improve that to make sure that they want to come back again and again? Instead, I think we just kind of look at it and we just kind of lump it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you need to lump it all together in terms of your revenue model, but you also got to divide it and meet everybody's needs. You gotta meet your customer where they are.
That's a great call. And I'm going to throw that out the text line. That's a great point brought out by Jerry. 49451, what are your needs as a college football fan to go to the games? Why, if you were someone that consistently went to Husky games, Cougar games, for a long, long time, and you love going to watch college football, but you just don't go as much anymore as you used to, why is that, and what would get you back? We'll get some of those texts at 49451 a little bit later on the show, but first, we got Cliff Averill, our old friend, coming up next, right here on 93.3 KJRFM.
Hear us anywhere, anytime, on Alexa or Google Play at Sports Radio 93.3 KJRFM and on the iHeartRadio app. Now back to Softy and Dick.
Softy and Dick without the soft bun, but we do have Jerry Brewer in the house tonight until 7 o'clock. And joining us now, one of our old friends and old colleagues here at 93.3 KJRFM. Way back when it was called, you know, Jerry, it was once called 950 KJRAM back in the day. Long, long time ago.
I remember that.
And I think Cliff Averill does as well. Cliffy, how you doing, man?
Man, I cannot complain. I can explain how you guys doing in the new studio and FM and all that good stuff.
I know, man. We've just come so far, right? We got a brand new studio here. We actually have a view of the water because you remember what our view was in the other side of the building, right?
Yeah, not that great.
Yeah, we'd like encampments and Baskin Robbins with graffiti on the side. And now we got a view of the water here over on this side. But we got you on for a couple reasons. Obviously, we want to talk Seahawk football with you. But first and foremost, Sunday, June 26th, 3 o'clock at Climate Pledge Arena. What is Cliff Averill going to bring us in the form of a basketball game at Climate Pledge Arena? Tell us about Champions of Change.
Well, first and foremost, we're just excited about bringing some basketball back to the city. You know, of course, Jamal has, you know, his crossover camp, but more so than anything, everybody's kind of, we need something to weather the storm before hopefully, you know, we get a professional basketball team back here. So June 26th, we decided Doug Baldwin, Michael Bennett, myself, we partnered up We all do a lot of different things in the community, and we thought we'd make a bigger impact if we all came together, and that's how we came up with Champions of Change. But even more so, the basketball game at Climate Pledge Arena, it's to bring basketball back to the city, but it's all for a great cause. We're going to have a bunch of Seattle greats in the building, from Marshawn Lynch and Sue Bird being the coach of one team to Gary Payton and Sean Kemp coaching the other team. So you know it's going to be a great time.
Well, who's playing? That's a big question.
Oh, man. Well, who's playing? I mean, I'm a hooper, but nah, let's start with the real hoopers. We got Jamal Crawford. We got IT. We got, of course, Michael Bennett. Martellus Bennett's going to be in the building. Sherman's going to be in the building. Doug. I mean, the list is long as far as for guys that are going to be hooping. Spencer Hawes. I mean, it's going to be competitive. Trust me. It's going to be very, very competitive. We're going to have some fun with it. But, us athletes, we want bragging rights, too, especially against some of the NBA guys.
Oh, man, let me tell you, Cliff. I mean, football players are such incredible, strong, explosive athletes. And I remember being in high school when we would be doing open gym. I would hate it when football players would come in there. And there was a couple of, the team was kind of half and half. Like, a lot of football mm-hmm. players played basketball. Then there was a lot of us who, I was a baseball player when I wasn't playing basketball. So I was puny. Mm-hmm. Because y'all just so physical.
Oh, yeah.
And like, they all, like, you'd have, like, five. Yeah, you get the wide receiver who's 5'8", 205, can dunk. Can't do much else, but, like, it's just a crazy explosive athlete, blocking your jump shots and all that. I used to hate it when football players would come in there.
Well, I'm going to tell you right now, Matt, football players, if we could rewrite this whole thing, and had about 3 or 4 inches taller, we all would think we'd be in the NBA right now.
That's right.
We all believe we're some NBA players. Deep down inside, like, I mean, it's my first love, and majority of the guys would say the same, So it's going to be fun, man. It's going to be a great time. But, again, it's all for a great cause, and it's also about bringing families out, bringing families out that weekend to just get some basketball and see some of their favorite athletes.
Cliff Averill joining us. You're pairing up with Doug Baldwin and Michael Bennett. Is this something that you guys have talked about for a long time? And is this going to be an ongoing thing where you're going to kind of merge your foundations together and go do things in the future as well?
Most definitely. It's something we want to keep building off of. The biggest thing right now is we all three of us have three different organizations that we're raising funds for with this game. Mine is Odessa Brown. I've been working with them for a few years now, and I love everything that they do in the city. Michael Bennett is Humble by Design, and Doug is Dads. And it's all about, obviously empowering the city, but more so than anything, these organizations don't get enough credit for what they're doing, right? So we want to shed light on them and make sure that people understand how valuable they are to the city, to the community, and also be able to raise some capital and funds for them.
Cliff, tell us about this enduring bond. I mean, Dick and I were watching the Champions of Change video, and I don't think that story of the 2010s Seahawks gets told enough. Mm-hmm. I mean, we talk about how things ended, but we don't talk enough about that. And I think that was just a kind of a special way that the team had.
For sure, man. It was extremely special, but I think also with even the players, we all took it for granted, the city as well. Just in a sense of, we didn't realize as players how great we were, as a team, but also we didn't really, like, I understood it. Michael Bennett understood it. Guys that have played in other organizations understood how unique the situation was that we had back in those days, where all these superstars, you talk about Richard Sherman, Marshawn Lynch, Michael Bennett, very guys that got characters, guys that have a voice that, just say what they want to say. A lot of times that doesn't work. It doesn't work out because ego and whatever else. But the difference, I think, for all of us was we all had respect for one another, and we also understood that we couldn't be who we are in that moment without the guy next to me, without Marshawn Lynch, without Richard Sherman, without, we understood that in order for any of us to have success, we need that person next to us. And again, that's not a common thing in the NFL. That's not a common thing in professional sports. Honestly, that's not a common thing in corporate America where, you know, coworkers just genuinely like one another, right? And hang out with one another. Till this day, you see us doing coming together to make an impact in the community, but we all go play basketball together at the rec, at the local gym. We all go on vacations together. We're all going to see kids, you know, to birthday parties and different things like that for our kids. So it's a genuine respect, but love for one another. And I think that's what made us so good for so long.
Cliff Averill joined us. And Cliff, we saw a little bit of DK at the voluntary OTAs, and now we're into mandatory.
Pay the man.
What's that? Pay the man. Okay, simple as that. Okay, next question. No, so he's not here. I mean, is that something that, you know, Hawks fans should be worried about, or is he kind of flexing the only leverage he has right now because the collective bargaining agreement's different now when it comes to holding out of training camp versus what it used to be holding out of training camp?
No, I think it's one of those things like, hey, you know, I wouldn't take it serious in the sense of being concerned that he won't be here or being concerned that he won't be ready or anything like that. I mean, DK's been in the league for a few years now. He understands what it looks like to be a pro. He understands, how to get ready for the season. So that shouldn't be an issue. And I hope, you know, fans understand that piece. But as far as for him not being here, I wouldn't take it serious. I mean, it's mini camp. It's nothing other than that. You know, honestly, if I had my choice, I wouldn't have showed up to any of them either. You know what I'm saying? Actually, I did show up to a few of them. And it's just more along the lines of, you know, it's nothing serious right now. Now, once he starts missing half of the fall camp and different things like that, then, okay, we start scratching our heads and start asking what the heck is going on.
Right.
But right now, let's pump our brakes. It's nothing to be concerned with. I think it's more along the lines of, you know, hopefully they can figure out the business side of it. But overall, I don't see this being a big deal just yet.
Hey, Cliff, you've seen enough of what the Seahawks are trying to do with this building, this young defense, and them being kind of a 3-4. I know they're still going to be multiple and do all kinds of different things, but I guess they're calling themselves a 3-4. I'm wondering, like, what can we expect from a defense like that that might be different from some of the great defenses that you played on?
I think the biggest thing is, believe it or not, I would have preferred as a pass rusher to be in a 3-4 because most times than not, you're just playing the pass. You're playing the pass, you know, and if it happens to be a run, we'll fall into it, right? So it's one of those things that with these young pass rushers that they have, they think that they're one-on-one options because that's essentially what a 3-4 allows you to do is it allows everyone on the D-line to have one-on-one options. You know, when you're in a 4-3, two people get double-teamed, another person might get chipped or something like that. Mm-hmm. This allows guys to get those one-on-one opportunities. And with the pass rushers that they've drafted, the pass rushers that they've had in the building, they feel very confident with those guys being able to attack, these tackles and also running backs. When you're in a 3-4, you get a lot of one-on-ones with running backs with the outside linebacker, and you should like your odds in those situations, right? So I think that's what they're kind of building. Plus with Coach Hurt being a D-line coach, I think that's going to help the pass rush, which also helps the back end as well. So I can see both sides, both the front up front with the sack numbers and on the back end getting more picks and making bigger plays. I can see the production going up big time with the shift in scheme like this.
We got to run to a break. Do you have a few minutes if we brought you on for one more short segment, or you got to run?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. We'll have more Cliff Averill coming up next on 93.3 KJRFM.
Hear us anywhere, anytime on Alexa or Google Play at Sports Radio 93.3 KJRFM and on the iHeartRadio app. Now back to Softy and Dick.
Oh, Cliff's such a great guest. We have to have him on for 2 seconds. We got way too much to talk to him about, but we had him on first segment talking about his Champions of Change game. Buy your tickets, Ticketmaster. Right now I'm seeing, hey, if you want to go big show, you can pay $500 if you want. But if you want to just get the family in, I'm seeing tickets for $10 a piece. June 26th, Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock. You got Gary Payton and Sean Kemp coaching one team. You got Sue Bird and Marshawn coaching the other team. Is that right, Cliff?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I mean, the lineup is awesome. I'll run through them again, matter of fact. We got Jamal Crawford. We got IT. We're going to have Nate. Nate Burleson is going to be there. Nate Robinson is going to be there. Jermaine Kearse. I mean, the list is long. Jason Terry is going to be in the building. The Jets going to be in the building. Go. Like, let's go. It's going to be a good time.
That's going to be fine. My son and I saw your TV commercial yesterday, and you know, he just dropped my son's crazy. He just drops the funniest lines sometimes, and he saw the guest coaches, right? And he saw wow, GP, Sean Kemp, Sue Bird, and then he goes, Marshawn's going to get run. What does he know about coaching basketball? So you can pass that along to Sean, all right?
I'll definitely let him know. But he's like, bro, I'll coach, but make sure y'all have a uniform for me. I want to get out on basketball court. I'm like, I don't want you to embarrass yourself.
You know he's going to get out. I remember, Cliff, a locker room conversation with Marshawn. I'm not sure you may not have been on the team yet. This was like when Marshawn first came, and he talked about how he dunked on a 6'10 dude in high school once.
I believe it. I believe it. Absolutely.
I don't know if I do. I'm not sure.
And I can't tell the full story, but like, we're like, man, how in the world did you dunk on a 6'10 dude? Well, it turned out, you know, he made it known that, you know, it was not a brother. It was 6'10. It is very Marshawn Lynch way.
Oh, that's great. Cliff Averill, join us. Let's talk some more Hawks here, Cliff. And, you know, Jerry brought up some really good points about how they're building this team up and how he really thinks they're going to be competitive. And I think they're going to be competitive as well. I just think by Pete's nature, he's never had a team win less than 7 games. But I can also understand the thought process behind people saying, they're going to suck. They don't have a quarterback. Every team that doesn't have a quarterback sucks. So where do you kind of stand on that continuum of they're going to suck because they don't have a quarterback and, hey, Pete knows how to build winners?
Well, I mean, that the latter of what you just said, Pete knows how to win. Like, that's just like that. I mean, if you go back to his SC days, he just knows how to win. You look back even early on when he first got to the Seahawks and how he built that team. You got to remember, he built that team from scratch, too. You know, what he had the most guy transactions that year or whatever it was. Yeah. So, you know, and then came the Super Bowls and then the Richard Shermans and all these guys. Like, so he understands how to do that. And I also understand the question mark at the quarterback position because, honestly, that's my question, too. But, again, Russell Wilson wasn't just he wasn't the number one pick overall. Like, we didn't know he was going to be who he was, right? So they clearly see something in the quarterback that they have. We have to believe them. And I mean, at some point, you just have to believe that Coach Carroll knows what the heck he's doing. The man consistently wins ball games. He's consistently in top of the division. He's been able to put rosters together and be able to win ball games. So let's see him do it again. Let's see if he can do it again. I have faith in just the resume itself, you know, and that's what I'm relying on.
Cliff, at the top of the show, we had Shelby Harris on.
Yeah.
And there was just something about him that reminded me of you guys. Like, and not necessarily in the way that he plays, but just in – the way that he's wired, his mentality, just his
maturity.
He's a little bit older than you guys were when you came to Seattle. But what do you like about his game, and what is he going to add, especially with being a guy who can get 6 or 7 sacks on the interior of the defense?
Mm-hmm. I think the biggest thing, I mean, he's going to be one of those guys that you need to honestly soak up some of those double teams too, right? So some of your linebackers can get downhill and play. But also with a veteran like him, that's needed because it's not that many old players on the D line. And I think sometimes fans or even coaches, honestly, don't put too much emphasis on leadership from a veteran player that has done it, that has played in some games. Like, young players are looking for that type of leadership. So having someone like that in that D line room, I think is going to be huge. But also for the defense, you know, he's had some great players around him. So he understands what that looks like, and I think he'll make a big impact just by his presence and his experience.
You mentioned letting those linebackers loose. I'm excited for another year of Daryl Taylor and Jordan Brooks. I mean, what's the upside potential of those two dudes?
Man, I'm so looking forward to seeing those guys get down. You know, both of them are explosive. Both of them can bend the corner. But in particular, I think the biggest thing with both of them is they have some features and abilities that you just can't coach up. You know, they have a knack. They know how to bend the corner. They know how to get around the edge. And this is all just raw ability. Now, when you start adding the technique to it, you start adding the hand combat piece to it, I think they can do some damage on some quarterbacks. Now it's all about them refining that stuff and getting with, you know, individuals to learn that. And also, again, it goes back to having some veteran players on your team that can just learn it from those guys, but they kind of got to outsource it a little bit. But I expect nothing but big things from both of those guys. They both have just those talent, those things that you just can't coach up.
Before I let you go, what were you and KJ chopping it up with John Schneider about last week at OTAs?
Trying to get a job. No, I'm just joking, man. Before anybody goes crazy with it. I've been seeing that on Twitter and all that good stuff. He just stopped by and was just topping it up about the team. Just, you know, asking, you know, what do we think as far as for, you know, the little bit of practice that we see. But nothing serious. John is my guy. John supports a lot of the things that we do in the community. People need to pump their brakes. We can actually have a genuine conversation and not be about coaching or anything like that.
Hey, man, it's going to be fun to see you again on June 23rd or June 26th, 3 o'clock Sunday, Champions of Change. Go out and see The Glove, The Rain Band, Sue Bird, Marshawn Lynch, Cliff, Doug, Jamal Crawford, cast of thousands at Climate Pledge for Little Hoop, man. It's going to be awesome. We appreciate you all you're doing in the community, man.
No, thank you, guys. Appreciate the support, and you guys keep up the great work.
Sounds good. Cliff Averill, that's our guy. We'll come back. We got another hour of radio with Jerry Brewer. We got to talk about this golf thing that's going on, man, this Live Tour thing. We got to get Jerry's take on that. 93.3 KJR FM.